The Guardian.
While technology marches onward, so does a certain preoccupation with immersion and realism. But to me, virtual space is especially interesting when it acts as a deconstruction of some of these concepts. For example, imagine a digital museum of water. You'd have your plinths filled with different kinds of water assets as rendered by different kinds of video game and digital art engines. The water in its plinth will perform physically as it is designed to perform. It ripples softly or it speeds along. So what I've described exists. It's a virtual museum created by Pippin Barr, an assistant professor in the Design and Computation Arts Department at Concordia University. Pippin is one of my favorite artists working with what I guess you can call video games, designed interactions that take place in virtual spaces. He kind of famously made an 8-bit version of Marina Abramović's museum experience, The Artist is Present, complete with $25 you can pay to the actual Museum of Modern Art. This museum of graphical water, which Pippin calls VR3 and which you can visit yourself via his website, pippinbarr.com, emerged in part from some work his students were doing with a popular and very common game engine called Unity.
I teach a game studio course at the university I work at, Concordia University in Montreal. There's a bunch of students and I'm still actually trying to figure out how to teach it, but we make games and I try to get them as much as possible to make weird, interesting stuff. One of the students was using Unity. He was showing me his progress on his project and he showed me a level in his game that took place entirely in this waterscape. It was dark in the level. All of the floor, or whatever you would call it, was water. And he had these neon objects that were kind of reflecting in the water. And we were both kind of marveling at how amazing the water looked, basically. Like, it really did look quite stunning. We were very impressed, let's say, by the water. And he told me that the water, because I was interested in like how he got this great effect, and he said it was this free water that was called Unity Pro Water. So it's pro as in professional. And I just thought that was hilarious. I thought that was much too funny not to, you know, eventually do something with, I don't know how serious that is in terms of how it's, you know, it's taking itself very seriously, but it speaks of all of these very strange, I guess, relationships between technology and the natural world and stuff like that.
Video games in particular have always touted plausible water, realistically rendered water, as a kind of benchmark, a high watermark, if you will, of the graphical power of a product. Even in games where you can't actually splash or swim or enter the water, there's a certain value conferred on the experience of standing at the shore, thinking about how real it looks.
So I realized that, you know, the water it's actually pretty interesting to look at. And it ties into, I guess, this weird tech fetish culture in video games, especially around how successfully certain things can be rendered, and water is often taken as a major example of that. And so I started playing around with the water in Unity, realized that you could parameterize it in different ways to get different effects. This is the Unity Pro Water in this case. And so then it became clear you could sort of display it as this, you know, look at this water, you know, these are the different ways that this water can look under different circumstances. And that started to feel pretty interesting.
The Water Museum, which again is titled VR3, is actually the third in the series. It was inspired by Ziv Schneider, creator of something called the Museum of Stolen Art. Now, this is a wonderful topic almost all its own. The Museum of Stolen Art is a virtual space where you can go and view digital representations of culturally significant artworks that have been stolen or destroyed.
She made this project where she had gone through, I believe it must have been the FBI database of stolen artworks, and found images of the various things that had been stolen, and she put those on display in a virtual museum. So there was the idea of kind of, I guess, reclaiming these stolen things by making them accessible again. And I, being who I am, wanted to do the opposite thing, which was that if you had a gallery of stolen art, then there would just be nothing inside it at all. So I kind of started out, that was my sort of first virtual museum, was a museum with nothing in it on purpose, I guess.
When we come back, things start to get really interesting. Virtual art museums inspired by real-world art houses. Stick with us. This is Chips with Everything, and I'm Lee Alexander. Welcome back. We have designer and professor Pippin Barr on Chips with Everything this week, talking about why he made a virtual museum of graphical water assets. First, though, let's explore some of the ideas leading up to this project. Did you know that in Germany there's a house, near a lead mine, that no one wanted. It became the haunting and provocative project of artist Gregor Schneider, who continued to do increasingly unsettling renovations on the property.
He was given this house, and I guess he was a weird kid, so he would go to this house and he just continuously renovate it in very strange ways. So not to make it look nice, but to make all these quite odd rooms in the house. And there was a room that rotated slowly, so when you went in, it would be rotating, and you wouldn't come out the same door. Very video gamey, actually, in a strange way. And he was very interested in making walls in front of walls and things like that, like these very kind of almost philosophical pieces of, I guess, interior decoration and architecture. He's a fascinating guy, and he's made a lot of really weird work. But that house of his is really kind of where it all starts for him. I was in love with his work, and I wanted to do something like that with video games.
So imagine one of Gregor Schneider's houses just in the middle of a normal street.
You would go into this house, and it was kind of not a very nice rundown space. There were actors in there, or people in there who would ignore you. There's a woman in the kitchen, I think, who was crying over the dishes. Upstairs, I think there was maybe a body in a bag that would kind of move around when you came into the room. Super creepy. But the creepiest thing about the work is that you would see all of this stuff and find it to be kind of creepy and amazing. But then you would leave, and the person who was accompanying you would lead you down the street a ways, and you'd go into another house, and it was exactly the same. So again, like a very strange, sort of almost video gamey kind of experience.
Of course, in a video game, the feats of illusion, construction, and deconstruction that Gregor Schneider accomplished with his houses becomes a much more trivial matter. It's not so impressive to create that kind of disorienting surprise in a digital space where anything can essentially be drawn up and changed in real time.
His work, you know, loses resonance if you just try and recreate it in the most obvious way. So instead, I recreated one of his most famous work is the specific room called UR1. So I recreated that room in Unity with my pretty mediocre 3D skills and set about deconstructing it in different ways that video game spaces kind of allow for. So including duplicating it, but also suspending it in the air or decomposing it into its constituent parts or kind of just dropping it from the sky so that it shatters on the ground. And thinking of different ways that I could kind of use, I guess, the affordances of Unity, which is the game engine that I was using, and kind of learning at the same time, what were the different kinds of configurations, I guess, of the architectural space that Schneider was so obsessed with as a different kind of way of projecting that sort of obsession that would make more sense as a form of, I guess, labor inside a game engine.
The longest-running house project of Schneider's was called UR, after the streets it was on, and Pippin has done 3 VR titles as a sort of virtual space continuation of these ideas. What does it mean to hide a 3D object in virtual space? If an asset is inside a box and the player can't see the asset nor open the box, is that digital object even real? How do we determine what determines if that non-physical thing is there? That conceptual prompt, and some artillery sheds full of aluminum boxes by minimalist artist Donald Judd, led to Pippin's second museum, VR2.
VR2 was about the idea of whether things exist in virtual spaces when you can't have any experience of them. There's this artillery shed like Judd's shed, and there are these default cubes. So for people who make games, there's this sort of concept of the default cube, which is just a primitive object. It's literally just a cube. It has no textures applied to it, so it's sort of grayish. And it's sort of the ultimate nothing, I guess, while still being an object. And into all of these default cubes that I had arranged in a grid like Judd's work, I tried to put, I think, every sort of thing that Unity can represent in space, more or less. One of them had a cube inside it, another one had a sound inside it, another one had a video game avatar inside it, another one had a horse inside it, and so on. So only one of the things was an actual model, which I did get from the asset store, that was the horse. Everything else is just a kind of a default Unity structure. So a light, for example, is just something in Unity that you just there's just a menu, and you say, let there be light, and then there's a light in the scene that you're working on. So I put a light in a box. And I think there were about 24 or so of these different kinds of objects, a tree, a landscape, etc. And all of them are inside these cubes. So when you play the game, you can't see them at all. They're effectively not there. And if you're just playing the game and you're not me, for example, you've got no real way of confirming or denying whether or not those things are there, except that there's a big placard that tells you what's inside each box. So you can read the description and know what I'm telling you is inside the cube, but you can never see that thing or experience it. The tension of reality and non-reality for something that can't be seen or experienced, but what at least a large number of people got out of it was, is he lying or not?
Questioning the reality of virtual objects then sort of becomes a parallel for the way people question the function of contemporary art, maybe. And that brings us to Pippin's third museum in the series, VR3, the one with all the water.
So in Donald Judd's, in the original 100 Untitled Works in aluminum, there are two buildings, both of which have lots of these boxes in them, these aluminium boxes in them. So in VR3, there's the same two buildings, slightly altered, but basically two buildings, one of which has only got Unity's freely available default water in it with different parameter settings, so you can contemplate what differences the different parameters make. And the other building, which is actually the one that you walk into first in the game, is filled with what I kept calling third-party water, which is water that was available on the Unity asset store, either for free, but most often you had to pay for it. So I bought a whole lot of water and put it into these plinths in this building as another kind of way of meditating on different aspects of water, I guess, in that setting.
There's actually quite a lot going on in this deceptively simple virtual space. Pippin said he felt overwhelmed trying to categorize it all. But it's that provocation about reality versus tech that he says tends to stand out.
The most interesting thing for me is kind of those tensions between, for want of a better word, real water, like the water that we actually encounter in our day-to-day life, and this idea of technological representations of water and what, you know, thinking about what those differences are. It's really interesting just thinking about, you know, why are they different, you know, for what purpose. Sometimes it's obviously because, well, for one thing, real water is one of the most, you know, kind of complicated systems in existence, and people famously kind of can't model it successfully in terms of real fidelity to how water behaves, because it's, you know, this kind of chaotic system. There's a huge amount going on there. And also because obviously water in a video game, which is what all of the water in VR3 is, you know, was originally intended for, at least, it serves a different kind of a purpose. Like, it's there kind of in a sense to just look like water, which I find really, really strange. It's not that it needs to be water most of the time. In most of those games, you don't interact with the water in a meaningful way, but it's just meant to look like water or kind of symbolize water successfully.
It's funny as well to think about the fact these are graphical assets. Some of them are made by third parties, you know, people who make graphics to go in your toolkit. So some of the waters in the museum have different price points.
Like, I did actually buy one super expensive water. It was only $35, but it felt like a lot of money to buy water when you've got perfectly good free water. Like, and some of those kind of capitalistic dimensions are really weird and interesting as well. But that one did have kind of splash physics and stuff, so you could drop an object in it and it would look as though, and again, you know, this is the thing, right? It's all the simulacrum, so it would look as though a splash happened and it had flotation and stuff, but it was actually really, really hard to work with, and I didn't end up putting it in as well, because in VR3 you can't interact with the water in the plinths, and so it was kind of pointless that the water had all of this functionality that you know, there was no way for you to see. It kind of goes back to VR2 and that question of whether something's real if you can't experience it.
And actually implementing this water with behaviors all written by programs was something of a challenge for someone like Pippin, who self-describes as not so good at 3D work.
Like, one of the big sort of storylines of this water museum is that it was so hard to make, and it just looks like it should have been so easy. Which is, it was really puzzling to me. Even as I was doing it, I was constantly kind of shocked by how hard I was finding it to just put some water, you know, put some water into a plinth. Which, if you think about doing that in reality, you would just, I don't know, get a tea kettle or something and just tip it in, and it would be done. But in a video game, it turned out to be a nightmare for various reasons. Everything kept going wrong. The main thing that goes wrong is this really fundamental thing, which is that the water kind of wants to be an ocean or a lake or something. That's sort of its natural state in terms of this digital water. Like, it's generally implemented to take up a lot of space, horizontal space, like it's going to be a pond or a sea or something. And I was constantly trying to put it into these very small spaces, and it kind of, you know, I don't want to personify it, but it kind of didn't like it, and it behaved in very weird ways, whether it was perhaps to just go completely flat, so it had absolutely no watery characteristics at all. That happened a lot. Some of it developed these incredibly terrifying jagged waves that would kind of jut 5 feet into the air and kind of spike around really menacingly. Some of it just refused to be put into a plinth, and like I would put it in and then it would still be like the size of an ocean. So many things happened. Yeah, it flooded the museum.
So my producer, Ian Chambers, is with me in the studio today. Ian, it's always nice to have you join us.
Hello.
Hi. So you, when I told you about this episode, you were excited to hear Pippin reference Gregor Schneider, as you've actually been to one of the houses in London.
Yeah, probably 10 years ago, I went to the Schneider House in East London. And not only is it the scariest artwork I've ever seen, it's probably the scariest experience I've had in my life that I can remember. It was genuinely shocking. So Pippin's already described the house. And, you know, I was kind of awestruck. I guess it was a bit like a simulacrum for a video game in three-dimensional actual reality, because you go into one house and, you know, you obviously have a good look and you're encouraged to spend time there. You know, you sit down and see these kind of scary people doing random things. And then when you go next door, all of the detail, right down to the marks on the floor, on the wall, or whatever, are identical. And here's the utterly creepy bit. All the actors are exactly the same because, you subsequently find out, they're all identical twins. It's nuts. It's
wow. Normally you would need to make that in a digital engine to make that experience possible.
Yeah, it's genuinely mind-blowing. And I lasted probably all of about 15 seconds in the second house because I was so creeped out by it.
That's so strange, and I think it's so cool to just think about what changes when we take an artistic concept like that and see what resonance it has when we make it virtual, what kind of thoughts it can provoke on our relationship to tech, the digital world, the natural world.
Yeah, I think this idea of flitting between the two, like Pippin talks about how recreating some of the Schneider work in a computer reality takes away some of its sort of legitimacy or power. But then, you know, that opposite of making something that is a little bit like a computery concept, like the Schneider House, two identical houses with two identical sets of people, that is a really interesting area. And I'd love to see more artists doing that, like rendering in real life computer game concepts.
Yeah, and I think projects like these can even sort of create a bridge between the digital world and the natural world, you know, makes us reconsider what the boundaries of our reality actually are.
Well, one weird, nice thing about the game that I experienced just today, so now that I live in Montreal, I'm not that close to water, and I grew up very close to water because Wellington, which is where I'm from and where I am now, is right on this big bay that opens out into the Pacific Ocean and so on. So I'm used to being around big bodies of water. And I went down to the water today because I was sort of roughly trying to think about the game and looked into the water. One of the weird things is that when I was fighting with all of the water in VR3, there's this thing I kept reading about and fighting with called caustics, which is a particular kind of optical effect that happens. It happens with all kinds of things, but it happens with water too, where light passes down through the water and it kind of creates these lines of light on whatever's underneath the water, those kind of ripply lines. And I don't think I've ever looked at those caustic lines through water before in my life, or noticed them or cared about them. But yeah, when I was down by the seafront today, I was just looking into the water and I could see them there. And I was like, wow, yeah, there you go. So it did actually teach me a little something about kind of the natural properties of water. The kind of extension on that is maybe creepier is that looking at the water really seriously, the real water, it really did start feeling like I wasn't clear on how real it was. Like, I mean, I know that it's real, but like it seemed really fake somehow, or like I didn't really know how to register that it was real versus that it was a kind of a simulation of something else. It's really well done, right? Yeah.
Well, that's kind of lovely and funny and strange, I think. So that's all we have for Chips with Everything this week. I'm your host, Lee Alexander. My producer is Ian Chambers, and thanks so much for joining us. You can learn more about all of Pippin's work, complete with documentation, on his website, pippinbard.com. And as for us, please subscribe to Chips with Everything, as well as other great Guardian shows on iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. If you've learned something new today, you had a good time, please give us a rating and review. It helps more people discover our program and the wonderful folks we get to have on it. Join us next week. We'll look forward to having you.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.